Hi, podcasters. This is Andy Studna, Associate Editor for Applied Clinical Trials, and I'm here today with our Editor-in-Chief, Lisa Henderson. For today's episode, I will be speaking to Lisa about some recent events in the industry, like conferences she's attended, and we will be touching on our previous issue of ACT in April, as well as what's to come for our issue in May. So thank you, Lisa, for joining me today. And first off, could you tell us about some of the conferences that you've been attending over the past few months?
Well, thanks for having me, Andy. It's really great to be on this podcast, the best podcast ever. But so let me just start. This first conference was online, April 20th and 21st. It was the Oracle Health Sciences Connect. And there were a number of interesting sessions for the clinical trials community, obviously about around patient centricity, decentralized trials. And there was one, this one that I'm going to talk about is integrating sensor-generated data to power clinical research and patient care. So it featured panelists from DIME. DIME is the Digital Medicine Society, the Veterans Affairs, Moffitt Cancer Center, and Takeda. And Jen Goldsack is the CEO of DIME. And she was discussing their cross-industry collaboration to build a framework around the sensor data. So that DIME Sensor Data Integrations Project, and I'm quoting from the actual website, will drive the successful scaling of sensor data across the healthcare continuum by ensuring that sensor data is accessible, trustworthy, and relevant. The use of digital clinical measures can power better decisions faster across healthcare and research. And so it includes the companies that I mentioned previously, in addition, Oracle and others. So Jen was explaining this initiative is to get the technical and business processes to go into the multiple data streams to combine view for multiple stakeholders over time. She then touched on all the multiple data streams. You know, it's not just sensors, but DIME maintains an open access library of digital endpoints that are actively being used in clinical development. She says that there's been a 700% increase of digital endpoints since their launch, which was in 2019. And there's 302 digital endpoints being used by 91 different sponsors for drugs, biologics, and devices. So, you know, of course, she says they're seeing a proliferation of remote patient monitoring for clinical care. And of course, we've seen uses of remote patient monitoring in clinical research, but then how you share that data. So they just are trying to figure out what makes all that sensor data available and reliable. From Takeda's observations, they said from a clinical development perspective, global clinical operations become even more complex with data and sensors. There's issues about customized approaches from all the regulatory authorities in each country around devices and data, and that they're just in the new exploratory phase. You know, if you are looking at different patients, you're looking at different ways of getting insights, you're getting patients that haven't been able to be in studies before, and then you have to keep all their data coming in. It's just a pretty complex area that they are all trying to group together so they can have one effective and cohesive strategy. So I would check out DIME's website. It has a lot of information around these initiatives that span all of digital medicine, of course, but you want to focus on the stuff that clinical trials is going to be central to. The next event I went to, which was last week, it was the Pharmaceutical Compliance Congress in Tysons Corner, Virginia. It's an Informa Connect conference, and it will be online this week. They also have another related conference, Transparency, Aggregate Spend, and HCP Engagement, in person in August. So if you want to check that out, you can Google it. But, and I'm saying this, like compliance and this transparency and stuff is more of a pharmaceutical executive topic. However, compliance applies to everyone in a pharmaceutical company. And believe it or not, clinical trials took a lead at this conference. As someone mentioned at the conference, crossing any kind of legal or ethical line that can get a company in trouble with the DOJ, Department of Justice, or the FDA. Usually it happens in the commercialization space, the sales and marketing space. They usually don't have to deal with it for R&D. However, in December 2021, the Deputy Assistant Attorney General identified clinical trial fraud as one of key four areas of enforcement focus by the Consumer Protection branch of the DOJ. So this is why it was brought up at the conference, because if somebody is going to say we're looking at clinical trial fraud, then, you know, the compliance people have to kind of take a look at that, make sure that their companies are okay, you know, and the other three areas they're focusing on, and this is the Consumer Protection branch specifically, so they can have civil or criminal penalties. But the other three areas that these members are focusing on are opioid fraud, COVID fraud, and defending litigation for the FDA. So COVID fraud, they expect that to just extrapolate like as we get through this pandemic, but that's separate from this. If you want to read the remarks, just Google FDLI Deputy Assistant Attorney General and his comments will pop right up. So he referenced two cases in Southern Florida, which highlight the risks at issue. And I am quoting not the press release, but the statements doc, as well as our efforts in this area. In this matter, five individuals have been charged in connection with a clinical trial fraud scheme perpetrated at a medical research center in Miami. The charging documents allege that the conspirators fabricated data in a clinical trial designed to investigate the safety and efficacy of an asthma medication in children between the ages of 4 and 11. So among other things, the conspirators falsified medical records to make it appear as though pediatric subjects made scheduled visits. They took study drugs as required and received checks as payment, when in fact, none of these things happened. So multiple guilty pleas have been obtained and significant and appropriate prison terms. So it's kind of a little crazy when you think about all the good people in clinical research that, you know, there are bad actors. But the Assistant Attorney General also said these two cases represent only a sample of the branch's clinical trial fraud enforcement efforts, and we expect to bring further actions in the coming months. So that part, we expect to bring further actions in the coming months, is what kind of got everybody's attention. You know, like what's going on? Where is it going on? Do we have a plan around this? So basically in a breakout session, the expert speaker noted that, you know, these were at the site level. It hasn't been a pharma, a CRO that has been targeted yet, but the expert noted that it could come down to your data. Could you have known or should you have known that there was something going on, like in your outlier data? It's a case of if you see something, say something, because one of these cases, and there were three other that she talked about, but a CRO alerted a sponsor to one of the instances of fraud. So it really does behoove you to err on the side of protecting the public. So that was it for the conferences. I do love the PCC conference though, but it'll scare you. There's a lot of stuff going on out there.
Thank you for all that information on those conferences, Lisa. And now, as we said towards the top of the podcast, you know, decentralized trials, patient participation are and have been two of the most commonly discussed topics in clinical trials for quite some time now. And very conveniently, those are the focuses of two of our most recent issues. So if you would, could you take us back to our current issue of ACT, which is out for April, and then give us a little look into the future for May?
Yeah, so the April in our decentralized trials, and to the comments that I made around the Oracle Health Sciences event around the sensors and data integration, that's really what pharma is looking for right now in the decentralized trial space, because obviously decentralized means one or more of a patient's monitoring will take place not on a site. So it's either going to be in home or, of course, with sensors and wearables and that data coming from the patient. It's just starting to proliferate. So we include that in that issue. And as Andy mentioned, you know, clinical trials has been looking at decentralized trials for a while. But when you think about it, we've been doing EPROs and ECOAs for a while now. So, and that is considered a digital data collection point. So it's the bigger pieces around digital devices, digital endpoints, digital biomarkers, software as a medical device. And we do talk about digital therapeutics as a area of use for decentralized trials. So digital therapeutics are a device. So usually we don't cover this topic in applied clinical trials. However, using clinical trials of digital devices or digital therapeutics is interesting. You know, it's kind of like it's the one side and the other side. You have the clinical trials for the one side and the clinical trials to prove that side. So you're using it in a clinical trial and you're trying to prove a clinical trial. It's kind of two sides of a coin. So that's what we kind of touch on in the main feature of April. And then May, yeah, patient recruitment, again, patient engagement, trying to focus specifically on recruitment, because now with the diversity, the underrepresented populations push, you see that patient engagement can start at a lot of places. And then patient retention almost becomes a secondary issue. So anything you can do for patient recruitment is this funnel. Patient retention is through that. And the whole thing is called patient engagement or patient centricity. So I think it would help more of us in the industry if we use more specific language, but that's a whole separate conversation. But we do cover patient recruitment in May. Our feature article, main feature, does focus on those recruitment areas of the funnel, you know, where you come in, where you get found in a trial. Is it through a physician? Is it through a physician with an EHR alert? Is it through, we didn't really touch on social media and advertising, but yeah, I mean, those are all still areas, but looking closer to where patients will be diagnosed is to get into the clinical trials, kind of what we focus on. So everyone look for that issue the week of May 9th. And just to touch on some breaking news, Andy, Tufts CES, the Center for the Study of Drug Development, just released its May-June impact report. And you can Google Tufts CSDD impact report where you can find a summary and pay for access. But I just want to share some of the statistics from this report, which is in Europe, demographic underrepresentation in clinical trials persists. So the report goes into a deep dive of data between 2007, 2017, which clearly, and some of the data goes up to 2019. So clearly in some portions of that data, you know, there hasn't been a full-on focus of diversity or underrepresentation, even though we've known for years that this has been a problem. So if you look at the data, you got to think about what you're doing with the data. But to that point, only 43% of all clinical trials supporting the approval of medicines in the EU provided data on study participant ethnicity. So then you look at some of the targeted areas, such as respiratory, anti-infectives, or CNS, have higher levels of underrepresentation of Black participants. And if we look at more pivotal trials for FDA approvals, showed higher levels of reporting on participant demographics than approvals of new medicines in the EU during the same time period. So that's really interesting data. It's really good to know. I mean, April 13th, the FDA released diversity plans to improve enrollment of participants from underrepresented racial and ethnic populations in clinical trials. It's a draft guidance, again, it released April 13th, and it builds on previous guidances around clinical trials diversity, but this one specifically calls for a recommendation that sponsors develop and submit a race and ethnicity diversity plan to the agency early in clinical development, and they say it's based on a framework outlined in the guidance. So you know, Andy, it's a guidance, you know, and it behooves the industry to look at guidances and try and do the best they can. So clearly, this is an area where people will be focusing on in the coming months and looking to implement those plans and such. So we'll continue covering that.
Well, thank you again, Lisa. Hopefully it was a nice change of pace for you to be on the other end of the questions for, I think it's the first time in our podcast brief history. So hopefully you enjoyed that.
Yeah, I hope people don't mind hearing my voice, my droning voice. But no, you know, we love this industry. So I could talk about this stuff all day. But thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.